Questions have arisen about the drafts being discussed and whether the Iranian team's amendments and proposals offered in the form of two written drafts at the beginning of the seventh round are still on the table.
Over the past few days, we have had various meetings at the levels of experts and senior political directors, during which the modifications, viewpoints and proposals of the Iranian side on the June 20th draft were discussed, and these discussions were positive and moving forward.
Iran says it would only go back to full compliance after the full and verifiable removal of U.S. sanctions. And while some sources say the Iranian demands are stalling progress, others, like Russia's lead delegate, maintain the atmosphere is positive amid intensive dialogue.
The important thing for Iran is that the current negotiations move forward and that all of the sanctions, the maximum pressure sanctions, are removed, and there's a verification process. And Iran really has to be compensated for all the damage that Western countries have done to the people of Iran.
On Sunday, a third working group focusing on the sequencing of compliance by all parties was held for the first time during the seventh round of talks. That was followed by a trilateral meeting between Iran, Russia and China. There's been no official word yet about the duration of the current round of talks. Homolesky, Vienna.
In the limelight.
At least 15 members of Congress who serve on the Armed Services Committees have had money vested in top defense contractors like Lockheed Martin, Boeing, and Raytheon. Companies in the oil and gas and defense industries infamously receive hundreds of billions of dollars in government subsidies through direct bailouts and tax loopholes each year. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Sharon Jung, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Investigation Finds At Least 48 Members of Congress Have Violated Stock Act. Stay tuned for more. At least 48 members of Congress and 182 top Capitol Hill staffers have violated a law meant to increase transparency and prevent conflicts of interest around stock trading in Washington, a recently released insider investigation found. According to the insider report, members of both major parties have violated the Stock Act, with violations between Democrats and Republicans about even. Most of the violations from Capitol Hill staffers and Congress members are due to late reporting, with some disclosures coming as late as 4 years. Many of these disclosures demonstrate conflicts of interest between lawmakers' investments and the industries they govern. Though late reporting violations come with a fee, these fees amount to what is essentially a slap on the wrist for members of Congress, the majority of whom are millionaires. Fees are typically just several hundred dollars, while many of the stock trades by members of Congress are worth hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not millions or tens of millions. Though some of the violations were for trades of small value or only a few days late, other late disclosures were egregious, insider found. This year, Representative Pat Fallon made dozens of stock trades that he disclosed a month late, worth around $17.5 million total. Representative Tom Malinsky didn't disclose dozens of trades that he made this year and last year until he was probed by reporters. Senator Tommy Tuberville was late to disclose nearly 130 stock trades from the first half of this year. Representative Diana Hochberger, meanwhile, failed to properly report over 700 stock trades that she and her husband made this year, worth as much as $10.9 million. Several of the nearly 200 Capitol Hill staffers who violated the Stock Act gave questionable excuses for not obeying the law, despite being required to attend ethics training that covered trading rules. Some staffers said that they weren't aware of the law or that they weren't sure how to disclose the trades. Many of the dozens of people that Insider reached out to for comment were unwilling to say why they violated the law. An anonymous source who formerly worked for the Senate Ethics Panel said that lax enforcement is one of the reasons why late disclosures were so common. Monetary penalties are relatively low, starting at $200 for filings that are over 30 days late. And if it's a staffer's first offense or if they're forthright about their reason for disclosing trades late, they are often able to get the fee waived entirely. Although waivers are supposed to be rare, Insider found 5 staffers willing to provide copies of their waivers. The investigation also found that many lawmakers have personal financial interests in industries that they are tasked with regulating. For instance, 22 Democrats who typically vote on environmental and climate issues have reported owing stocks in major oil and gas companies like Exxon and Shell. At least 15 members who serve on the Armed Services Committees have had money vested in top defense contractors like Lockheed Martin, Boeing, and Raytheon. Companies in the oil and gas and defense industries infamously receive hundreds of billions of dollars in government subsidies through direct bailouts and tax loopholes each year. Lawmakers have also made questionable trades regarding the pandemic. Many government officials, including Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell, have come under fire over the past 2 years for making suspiciously opportunistic trades just before the pandemic triggered a market-wide crash or a boom in certain stocks. The Insider report found that at least 75 lawmakers held shares in the 3 major vaccine makers, Johnson & Johnson, Pfizer, and Moderna, as coronavirus vaccines were being developed last year. Officials were privy to information regarding the pandemic that was not available to the public. These Stock Act violations lent credence to progressive lawmakers' campaign to bar top government officials from being able to trade the stock altogether. Senator Elizabeth Warren has introduced legislation that would ban stock trading for members of Congress, cabinet members, top staffers, federal judges, and White House officials. "We have entrusted these people with great power. They owe us great transparency," Public Citizen's Walter Shope told Insider, adding, "They're not even giving us minimal transparency."
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program The Key here at IRIB English Radio. Thank you for joining us here today. Today we're going to be looking at a question that sometimes people ask regarding the hadith of the cloak, or the tradition of the cloak, the hadith al-kisa. And obviously this is also related to the verse of purification, ayat tathir. We can pose this question in the following way. That according to the hadith of the cloak, the title of the family of the Prophet, the Ahlul Bayt, is limited to the five individuals mentioned in this tradition, meaning Imam Ali alayhi salam, Hazrat Fatima, Imam Hassan, Imam Hussein, and the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wasallam. At the same time, on the other hand, we know that we often refer to all of the Imams as the Ahlul Bayt, the family of the Prophet. So this seems to be contradictory. On the one hand, we're saying that the Ahlul Bayt are these five people, and at the same time, we are generalizing it to include all of the Imams, alayhi salam. So how do we resolve this contradiction? Right. So in response, we can answer this question from a number of different points of view. The first answer that we can give here is this, the limitation of the title of the family of the Prophet to the five individuals mentioned in the hadith of the cloak is relative. It's relative. It's not absolute. What do we mean by that? We mean this, that if the title of the family of the Prophet has been limited to these five individuals, it's with respect to other people who are not infallible, such as who? Such as the wives of the Prophet and other people related to the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, but who we want to exclude from this title of being the family of the Prophet, and obviously from being individuals who the verse of purification includes. But this, obviously, taken in this way, this limitation doesn't necessarily negate the idea that this title of the family of the Prophet can include other people as well who are infallible and are related to the Prophet, such as the other Imams alayhim as-salam. At the same time, and this is another answer that we can give, that the in other traditions, the word or the title of Ahlul Bayt or family of the Prophet has been used in a general way to include all of the Imams, such as the famous tradition of Saqalain, which you're aware of. The Prophet said, "Inni tarikun fikum as-Saqalain, Kitabullah wa itrati ahl bayti." In this tradition, the Prophet said, "I'm leaving behind you two weighty things, the Book of God and my family, the Ahlul Bayt." So he used the word Ahlul Bayt or family of the Prophet in a general way, because he's used it after the word my progeny, which includes all of the Imams alayhi wasalam. This is one way we can answer this question. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the problem of how the word, the title Ahlul Bayt or family of the Prophet, is limited to the five individuals mentioned in the verse or in the tradition of the cloak, as well as, and at the same time, it also includes all of the Imams, alayhi wasalam. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
Wouldn't want to hold on to his parents that much longer. And advanced technology and better health standards have granted that wish. But what if a population just goes on aging with no one to replace it? Well, with family planning and population control, Iran has gotten more than it asked for. Hence the motto, more children, stronger family. Sharp turn, as just 20 years ago, the motto was fewer children, better life. The thing is, every national policy is to help a nation prosper and have the nation protect it. And what Iran needs now is to grow a younger population. I'd say in moderation, given the economic and environmental situation of the country. So how do you get that delicate balance between numbers and conditions? For answers, stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today. Iran was one of the first countries to establish a family planning program. That was in 1967. But religion is not big on contraception, and the Islamic Revolution of 1979 would also require a bigger Islamic population. So in advocating population growth, the new governing body dismantled the family planning program. A population of just over 37 million increased to about 50 million by 1986, with a growth rate of over 3% per year. But a war can change much. Mr. Abdullah, he is a sociologist and Hojjatul Islam. That's a high-ranking cleric who made a trek down to Press TV Studios for an interview.
There are four factors involved in population and demographic changes. One is marriage, the other divorce, immigration and war, all of which we've already witnessed. We've experienced war during which many went to the front lines and lost their lives for the country. The other factor which is also related to war was that many of our intellectuals and scientists had to immigrate when they saw the atmosphere in the country unsuitable for living.
As the eight-year Iraq-Iran war came to an end in 1988, the government began to view rapid population growth as a major obstacle to the economic and social development of the country. And so, family planning was revived to promote small family size. In a pragmatic move which surprised many in 1993, Parliament passed a bill that removed most economic incentives for large families, while still paying attention to reducing infant mortality. The target was bringing total fertility down to 4 births per woman by 2011. But by 2000, the rate was already down to half that goal, and now Iran is faced with under 1.7 births per woman. This is while just sustaining a given population requires 2.1 births per woman. While the country's fertility rate today has reached about 1.6 children per woman, it was 6.5 children per woman in 1986. Just under 1,600,000 births were registered between March 2015 and 2016, but only about 1 million were registered between March 2020 and 21. That's within 5 years. Ms. Ghaz Ali, PhD, is chair of the Supreme Cultural Revolution Council.
Natural population decline is very different from a voluntary one. The voluntary population decline is due to population control, abortion, and the secular Western culture that gives people the impression that everything revolves around them, their desires, and their pleasures. Under that culture, a woman would seek education, then employment, and then a permanent job. In the meantime, she won't have the time for marriage and bearing children, so she'll put that off. A collection of all these will cost a girl her ability to bear children. In such a cultural environment where pleasure, power, and wealth are the only priorities, the birth rate will be on the decline.
The first concern is a potential labor crisis. Teenagers who were at high school between 1987 to 1991 are now in the labor market. This has opened a window of opportunity for production in the country. If we don't take advantage of the opportunity, that would lead to a population of senior citizens. If today, for example, we need to care for one senior citizen, we'll need to care for 15 in 2051. Imagine the workforce that is being added to that number. We're losing 15% of our workforce every year. We haven't seen any policy implemented to address the challenges related to the labor market, economy, workforce, and how we can keep them from retiring.
And a word of concern by Mohammad Ismail Akbari, senior advisor to the Minister of Health. The world has grown about 5 years older over the past 70 years. But the population of Iran has grown 10 years older in the past 60 years. As recently as 2020, Iran was recorded as having a population growth of 1.3%. The rate in neighboring Iraq was 2.3%, and in Saudi Arabia, it was 1.8%. That's according to World Bank data.
Our biggest challenge is political and security issues. Manpower is of prime importance in wars. If we have a mighty army, if we have a strong military power, we'll be safe from the threat of an invasion. But if our neighbors find out that our security forces and our ability to protect our borders have diminished due to the population decline, they'll certainly attack and divide our country.
Now, in 2021, senior citizens constitute about a tenth of Iran's 85 million strong population. While the country's population growth is less than 1.4%, the growth of the elderly is 3%. The elderly's population has increased from about 5 to 10% over the course of 5 decades, and it is predicted that this rate will triple in the next 50 years. Before anyone, this will be to the disadvantage of the elderly, because they will need the care of a dwindling productive population. the productive population or portion of society being between 15 and 65 years of age.
The government has taken all of these into account to turn them into past laws. It is pushing for economic solutions which will see, for example, food and medicine packages delivered to the homes of the people who are in their three lower income deciles. It will also provide them with the means necessary to undergo tests, be covered by maternal insurance. There are currently 3 million married couples, that is 6 million married people who are waiting for their first child, which is ruining their lives. Measures must be taken to prevent and treat infertility for them, for which insurance is introduced. They might be students and need loans for buying homes and getting married and starting a family.
Any shortages with people numbers, there's still time to make up for, because Iran's a young country. Still young, but aging, with frightfully low birth rates. The marriage rate alone has dropped by 40% in a decade, and alarms have been raised that in the next 20 years, Iran will be among the oldest countries in the world, and in the next 30 years, the oldest. What measure is the greater government taking to address its population concern? It has approved a law. That was on November the 17th to implement a population growth and family support plan for 7 years to reverse the declining trend of childbearing. The law is called the Family Support and Population Rejuvenation Law, and it outlaws sterilization and free distribution of contraceptives in the public health care system. That's unless a pregnancy threatens a woman's health, of course. Ms. Mohammad Beghi, PhD, is an MP. She came to share her views in the studio.
A problem we used to have was that over 3.5 million infertile couples in Iran weren't covered by insurance. We've attempted to cover 90% of the infertility treatment costs for IUI, IVF, and other cycles under insurance for the first time in Iran. About 30 of the 74 articles are related to the mother and child's health. 20 articles are related to the health ministry. Several articles are related to the Ministry of Science, Ministry of Culture and Islamic Guidance, and media like the IRIB. I believe about 7 articles are related to home loans from the Ministry of Roads and Urban Development and creating dormitories for married student couples, all of which are under the umbrella of providing housing for young couples. There are some financial facilities provided, including loans for the first to fifth children, which increases by a coefficient according to the number of children.
The plan stipulates, say, health insurance for infertile couples, providing services and facilities to working women, educational opportunities for student mothers, and ongoing medical services to pregnant women. Thing is, looking at global examples, it takes more than benefit packages that are out of proportion with general taxes and daily expenses to encourage sustainable coupling and childbearing. And money is not everything. Social attitude and belief and values also play a major role in the process.
Social issues are multi-layered and result from a complex set of factors. It's not scientific to emphasize a particular factor too much. Economic, cultural, social, political, and international issues certainly have their effects. The middle class in our society is more developed and doesn't suffer from the afflictions and problems of the poorer bracket. They lead healthier lives, and that's why they get married and bear children. Some 20 million households in the country are from the very group. Therefore, if the economy was an important factor, the rich must have been responsible for the highest birth rates.
We popped out to see how the man and woman on the street feels about having kids and government perks. Also, why they think marriage rates and the population are dwindling.
The economic situation is such that we can't have any more than 2 children, but the child brings joy to life.
The incomes are really low. I'm witnessing it myself. I have 2 children. They both go to work.
If they want to increase the population, they have to plan for what that takes too. That includes education, employment, and housing. They demanded in 1979 that the population be increased. It did, but then everyone got into trouble.
The situation in society is now such that it is economically difficult for anyone to get married at all. One might want to get married and have children. After all, everyone likes to get themselves together.
I don't know, maybe after the prices come down. Everyone's afraid right now. They buy things today because they could go out of stock tomorrow.
In 20 years, we'll be an old country. We'd have neither any youth nor a proper workforce. The support isn't important at this point. What they'll do in 10, 15 years will be important.
It's now up to say the fewer the children, the better. Because people can't make ends meet. Back in our day, there were a lot of kids and we enjoyed our time at home. But kids these days want it all.
There may be a lot of people thinking about getting married, but they're afraid of its problems. It doesn't matter if they're living in rich neighborhoods or not. They see the problems the married couples are dealing with. Maybe they're afraid of having the same problems.
Time for a short break. We'll be back in no time.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
To take a look at other countries, according to the UN, two-thirds of European countries have introduced measures to increase fertility rates, from baby bonuses and tax incentives to paid parental leave. It hasn't worked equally everywhere, and it generally tends to boost childbirth temporarily. But in the long term, it is stability, meaning having a home and country, and security, that is financial certainty as well as social preferences, that keep a population stable or growing. Italy launched an incentive package in 2015. That was an €800 payment per couple per birth. But Italy still has one of the lowest fertility rates in the EU, with 1.3 children per woman. More on other countries' measures and success rates after a quick media review, which will also be looking at other lands and their populations. For that, I give you Mohammed.
Welcome. I am Mohammed Gord, and in this episode's news section, we will be taking a look at the different problems of an aging population in various countries. Generally speaking, a rapidly aging population means fewer working-age people in an economy. And this in turn leads to a supply shortage of qualified workers, making it difficult for businesses to fill in-demand roles. On this issue, in an article titled Middle-Aged Iran, Zero Population Growth in 20 Years, Tehran Times says, population growth requires a capability to address the needs of a young nation. And according to the report, this can be achieved by various means including social and economic development, development of recreational and educational facilities, increasing the share of young people in managerial positions and among decision makers, and providing the conditions for growth and prosperity of the youth. 2 years ago, members of Majlis, the Iranian parliament, passed a law banning the employment of retirees. But to what extent has this been implemented? Statistics show that a quarter of the country's young population is quite absent in decision-making positions. However, if this young population is not exposed to practical empowerment, they will certainly face challenges in the future and will not be able to use existing opportunities for growth and lose the opportunity in management and decision-making. Meanwhile, BBC has also touched on the issue and released a report titled Seven Countries with Big and Small Populations.
This is despite the fact that the size of its population is expected to decline from today's numbers, dropping from 1.3 billion in 2017 to less than 1.1 billion by the end of the century. Nigeria and other countries in Africa are bucking the trend of population decline. According to the new Lancet study, the population of sub-Saharan Africa is expected to treble in size to more than 3 billion people by 2100. But rapid population expansion puts a strain on infrastructure and social structures, and Nigerian officials have spoken about trying to ease population growth. Thanks for joining me in this week's news section. And now, back to Veda.
France, with 1.92 births per woman, one of the highest fertility rates in the EU going by World Bank figures of 2017, is a demographic exception in Europe. That should be due to its balanced range of social policies. They offer subsidized childcare for younger children and a generous benefit system, especially for larger families, according to the European Commission.
Outside the United Nations and the Western viewpoint that values materialism and the economy, they believe that population means wealth and power. They believe four factors contribute to economic growth. One is having lands, facilities, and resources to make good money off. The second is the workforce, who work on the land and mines and the resources. The third is the technology and know-how to increase the efficiency of production. They believe it's workforce that can work on the materials and resources and make production work. If that's a strong population, wealth can be made. Else, we'll have to face poverty and prepare for extinction with the old population despite having rich resources.
Here's how Sweden has lived it. According to the European Commission, female and maternal employment rates in the country are among the highest in the EU, and child poverty is among the lowest. This is while parents are given a monthly allowance of around 1,500 kronas. That's $167. And the sum increases when the child reaches 11 and then 15. Now, Iran has also made an effort of its own, passing a law. Although the pragmatism of that law is yet to be seen once it's put into full practice. Focusing on shaping young minds in fertile bodies, the law stipulates that all higher education centers in the country must promote awareness towards the positive aspects of childbearing.
Another issue taken into consideration in the juvenilization of the population is support for young couples. Imagine recently married couples who are students.
Some 10% of budgets for the Ministry of Science, Ministry of Health, and the construction budget of the seminary are earmarked for building dormitories for married couples and their housing so they can experience parenthood at an early age. This is because, according to statistics, unfortunately, the average age at which women marry in Iran is 24. The figure is 29 for Iranian men. The families also bear children 4 to 5 years after marriage. With a quick calculation, you'll realize that an Iranian woman experiences motherhood at 29. This is while the best age for motherhood is between 20 to 24.
Iranian ministries of interior, sports and culture, and other relevant institutions are obliged to allocate 30% of their budgets to NGOs that work to reduce the age of marriage and encourage childbearing. Employees with 3 to 5 children will be promoted and maternity leave will be extended to 9 months, while paying full salary and relevant extras. The government is obliged to establish a life insurance and investment fund for unemployed housewives with 3 or more children living in rural and nomadic areas. This would happen by paying 70% of the life and investment insurance premiums. The Ministry of Health is to provide quality natural childbirth in state-run hospitals, in addition to providing free infertility treatment to the couples. Municipal public transportation services and cultural, sports and recreational tariffs are to be halved, and tuition for children in private schools and educational centers would include a 20% discount. Also, all production, distribution, and service units must include phrases highlighting childbearing support on products and goods.
The juvenilization of the population requires behavioral, social, and economic changes. Our economy is a bitter legacy of the previous administrations. They have made their contributions, but we haven't had an economic growth that would support a strong and dynamic economy. The other issue is the culture. If we want a younger population, we need to create a culture for it. We've written the plan, which is a very good one too. But how successful will the plan be when implemented?
It's all hands joining in phrasing a plan to boost healthy births. The Interior Ministry, in cooperation with the Statistics Center of Iran, is to continuously monitor the birth rate and total fertility rate in the country every year and submit the necessary proposals to the National Population Headquarters. That's regarding planning to improve the fertility situation in provincial areas and cities.
Let's assume we're trying to implement the mother and child plan. There's an improper structure for it. Do we recognize motherhood as a job? Have we decided on any sum of money for the mother for her time spent on caring for the children? Have we allocated any money for it in our budget? Unless these issues are addressed, nothing will change, even if we propose 1,000 other plans.
That'll be it for today. Thanks from the whole team. Do join us again at the same times next week and each week after, and bye for now.
The
is the culmination of a nearly three-year investigation by the Committee on Oversight and Reform launched under the late Representative Elijah Cummings, who died in 2019. He was succeeded as the panel's chair by Representative Caroline Maloney. The committee has obtained more than 1.5 million pages of internal company documents, held 5 hearings, and released 8 interim staff reports, Maloney noted in a letter at the beginning of the report, adding, "The investigation has provided a rare glimpse into the decision-making of many of the world's most profitable drug companies." Specifically, as the committee statement detailed, the probe revealed drug companies aggressively raise prices to meet revenue targets, and executive compensation structures create incentives to raise prices. Drug companies target the U.S. market for higher prices and use the Medicare program to boost revenue. Drug companies use strategies to suppress competition and maintain monopoly pricing. Drug companies use patent assistance programs as a public relations tool to boost sales, and research and manufacturing costs do not justify price increases. The panel investigated insulin products manufactured by Eli Lilly, Novo Nordisk, and Sanofi, and found that those companies targeted the United States for price increases, and Medicare lost out on more than $16 billion in savings. The trio also engaged in strategies to maintain monopoly pricing and defend against competition from generic versions of their brand name drugs. The committee also looked into Pfizer's pain management drug, Lyrica, and found that the drug giant targeted the U.S. market for price increases and used patent protections, market exclusivities, and other tactics to delay generic competition and keep prices high. After outlining the panel's key findings in her letter, Maloney explained that this staff report is intended to help Congress, regulatory agencies, and the public understand rising drug prices and pursue effective reforms to make prescription drugs more affordable. The evidence overwhelmingly supports the need to pass the Build Back Better Act, which will empower Medicare to negotiate for lower prices, restrain price increases, and cap out-of-pocket patient costs for insulin and other drugs, she wrote. Maloney also advocated for reforms to make pharmaceutical research and development spending more transparent and prevent anti-competitive practices that suppress generic competition and keep prices high.
The unholy alliance between the Israeli regime and the two Arab powers, namely the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia, has provided a breeding ground for crime, especially in cyberspace. It hasn't been a long time since the world was rocked by a wide range of cyber attacks these countries carried out, thanks to Pegasus, the signature spyware produced by the Israeli company NSO Group. Now it's become clear that both Abu Dhabi and Riyadh have been using yet another spyware, developed by yet another Israeli firm, Candiru, undermining privacy and threatening freedom of expression. Recently, ASSET, a Slovak internet security firm, revealed that a computer hacking tool made by Tel Aviv-based Candiru has been used to attack websites in some parts of the world, in particular the Middle East. In its detailed analysis, ASSET wrote, "The victimized websites belong to media outlets in the UK, Yemen, and Saudi Arabia, as well as Hezbollah, to government institutions in Iran, Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Syria, including the Ministry of Electricity, and Yemen, including the Ministries of Interior and Finance, to internet service providers in Yemen and Syria."
The links between Israel and the UAE regarding this technology are the same links that there are between Israel and the UAE politically. The UAE has recognized and normalized relations with Israel, and the Saudi government too, even though it hasn't fully recognized and formalized relations with Israel, it's been working closely with Israel for a long time, and they have the same interests in the region. Israel wants to protect the monarchies from and any kind of democratic revolution there, and the Gulf monarchies are siding with Israel in protecting the regime from any kind of uprising, of popular uprising, or Palestinian uprising in the countries of the region.
ASSET found a series of watering holes attacks between July 2020 and July 2021, in which attacks added malicious code to websites' JavaScript code to infect devices of targets of interest who were likely to visit those websites. The sites themselves, according to the cybersecurity company, are just a jumping-off point to reach the final targets. The primary goal of the attackers using the spyware is supposed to be collecting IP geo-collection data and the targeted computer system information, and enabling them to hijack the infected devices. The targeted websites include, but not limited to, Middle East Eye, a UK-based news site that has a critical coverage of the Middle Eastern regimes, the site of the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah's Al-Manar TV channel, and Yemen's Al-Masira, a media outlet affiliated with the Ansarullah movement, and the SaudiReality.com, a Saudi website critical of the Saudi monarchy.
But the Yemen situation, of course, is critical now for Saudi Arabia and the UAE. So, you know, they're going to use this software and these capabilities to bolster their position, to strengthen their position in the Yemenis' war. So, of course, anything having to do, and Yemenis, this war against the Houthis and with the Houthis in Yemen is a very dangerous war for Saudi Arabia, you know, and the Saudi regime might really be threatened if they lose this war in a nasty way. So they're going to make sure that they will use every tool that they have to spy on and as intelligence, to gather intelligence from what is their enemy in a war now, the Yemenis and the Houthis.
The hacking spree undermines the privacy of the users and can dissuade them from visiting the alternative media. It can also pose problems for independent journalists, putting their lives in danger In the words of the Director-in-Chief of Middle East Eye, David Hurst, this only further demonstrates the challenges of reporting independently and has serious consequences for the future of press freedom.
When this came out initially in April, there was some indication that, you know, wealthy private people in the UAE or Saudi Arabia can get their hands on this technology and use it against people all around the world. So what's happening is the technology itself is very powerful and very dangerous. And the cat's out of the bag in some sense. Once, you know, these governments think they can control it, but once it gets out in the wild, it starts, you know, it can be stolen and hacked and used by other players. So it's a very dangerous thing from the point of view of dissidents and journalists in the hands of governments that are authoritarian or repressive. And every government in some way will be for its own interests. But it's also very dangerous in the sense that this is now getting out of control, even of central government.
Back in July, Citizen Lab, an interdisciplinary laboratory at the University of Toronto, Canada, reported that CanBureau's clients include the governments of Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, as well as Qatar, Singapore, and Uzbekistan. The lab researchers believe that the attacks on journalists and activists were carried out from Hungary, Indonesia, Israel, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE. The fact is, the Israeli regime had been providing the Persian Gulf autocrats with its cybersecurity tools long before the Abraham Accords. For example, back in 2007, the Emiratis recruited the Israeli-owned firm 4D Security Solutions to bolster the security of their energy facilities and to install a smart surveillance system in their capital city. Likewise, according to former Israeli Knesset member Errol Margalit, in 2012, Saudi Arabia received assistance from Israeli cybersecurity firms for its oil and natural gas company, Aramco. However, this cooperation has been taking an increasingly aggressive course in recent months, if not years. Israeli companies say their products are meant to help governments fight terrorism, but the reality is fundamentally different on the ground. They have been used mostly to spy on computers, mobile phones, and cloud accounts of journalists, activists, and political dissidents in the clients' countries.
Of course, this is the line of the Israeli agent company, NSO, and the line of the Israeli government. We only sell our product to law enforcement and to governments that we know. Really, it's that we know are on our side, because nobody can claim that the Saudi government or the UAE government is a democratic government. But really, their claim is they're selling it to legitimate governments, quote unquote, for the purposes of, finding criminals and terrorists, etc. That's always what they're going to say. And then when something pops up that it's been used against journalists and dissidents, they're going to say, well, we didn't know anything about that. We can't control and it's the truth. They can't control what these governments do once they give them the software and the technology. And that's the problem here.
Giving double-edged software to despotic regimes under the name of fighting terrorism is a dangerous game to play. It is potentially a threat to every internet user, regardless of geography, nationality, or belief. Even the United States, Israel's staunch ally, has blacklisted both CanBureau and NSO Group for acting against its national security interests. Inaction on behalf of the international community will certainly cause incalculable damage to freedom of expression.
IRIB English Radio.